We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Lots to cover this week, starting with your regular endorsements issue. Is it just come out?
It just came out this week, and it's on the web, and people can actually see it just about the time they get their ballots, which is, you know, unusually efficient for us.
Yeah, I got my ballot last week.
Maybe we could get you guys involved with running King County's elections.
Yeah, well, they apparently need the help.
Yeah. So we can't cover all the endorsements this week. What are you going to
No,
give
we're
going to
we're going to split them up between this week and next week, or you can go see them all if you're so inclined, either with the print edition that's already out or at www.eatthestate.org. What we're going to do is split them up this week into the statewide offices and the King County Ballot Initiative, and then next week we'll take on the ones that fewer people know anything about, which are the state legislative races that are contested and the judgeships, the King County Superior Court, and some of the other judgeships that are up for grabs this time around.
Very good. All right, so dive right in.
Okie doke. We should mention, first of all, that it is a different primary system again this year. This time it is the top two primary, which actually renders most of the races I'm about to talk about irrelevant. Because they, in almost all of these cases, the two leading candidates are from the two major parties, since the statewide races are all partisan races. And they will, the top two vote-getters will all advance to the November election. So really, for the August election on August 19th, or if you mail it in before then, what we're talking about is sort of a preliminary straw poll based on who's paying enough attention that they actually want to vote in the middle of summer when people are off playing in the mountains and at the beach. And also it helps with different candidates in terms of fundraising. If they do well in the primary, or if it makes them a little bit more efficient in raising funds for the fall election, and vice versa, if they do very badly, they're going to have trouble raising funds. That being said, we do have some choices, starting with the race for the races for the various congressional districts. The only one that's really seriously contested is over on the east side, the 8th district, between Dave Reichert and Darcy Berner. And I think it's fairly safe to say that Darcy is a much better pick. We could spend about a full show talking about the reasons why if we were interested, but we'll save that for another week. But there are a couple of other non-traditional candidates that are running that are running on anti-war platforms and challenging incumbent Democrats, and I wanted to just mention those. One of them you had on the air at 7:30, Paul Richmond, who's running in the 6th District in Tacoma and Kitsap County and over on the Olympic Peninsula against Norm Dix. And then also Cheryl Crist is running in Southwest Washington up through Olympia in the 3rd District. And both those folks, for anybody who's registered to vote in those parts of the state, are well worth your support. The governor's race. This is kind of interesting because 4 years ago, when Christine Gregoire and Dino Rossi ran against each other, Gregoire was running as a very centrist attorney general and ran an awful campaign, and we weren't particularly impressed with either of them. I'm going to do a little bit differently this time, both because I think Rossi is worse, which is saying something because he wasn't very impressive 4 years ago, and because I think Gregoire, although she's had some faults, has done an unexpectedly good job as governor. She has managed to get the state legislature to act on some long-standing issues that Gary Locke, her predecessor, didn't really have any luck moving through the legislature. She restored some of the spending cuts to education and health care that we saw over the previous decade and a half. She's done some good things as governor, and our economy is actually in somewhat better shape than much of the rest of the country. If you're going to penalize people for a bad economy, I think you need to reward them for a relatively good stewardship. So we're gonna go with backing her. I should mention also that there is a Green Party candidate in the race, a guy named I'm drawing a blank on his name here. Duff Badgley He was not actually he actually was sort of endorsed by the statewide Green Party nominating committee, but did not come through the Green Party. And they're trying kind of hard to pretend that he doesn't exist because, frankly, he's kind of a crank, as anybody who looks at his voter's guide statement will probably figure out. So, unfortunately, he's running on climate change issues, and while he deserves credit for saying radical changes are necessary, many of his radical changes are unconstitutional or preposterous or both. So,
and Gregoire's been doing some work on that issue as well.
Yeah, and she's been relatively good on that issue with we've talked about on this show with the original climate change agreement and some other things that initiatives she's taken on.
All right. What else you got?
Lieutenant Governor. This is one where we have pretty much the same stance every issue. There's no particular reason for this office to exist other than that he sits around and draws a salary and runs an office just in case the governor gets hit by a bus. And the incumbent Democrat, a guy named Brad Owen, who's I think this is running his fourth term now, maybe, he has been using his copious free time, since he doesn't really have any responsibilities, to champion the war on drugs. Needless to say, this is probably something that he, rather than the victims of the war on drugs, should be in jail for. But there's nobody who's running against him this time who's calling for what this really office really needs, which is to be abolished. So we're recommending that you skip it. Secretary of State. This is kind of an interesting one. Sam Reed, the Republican, is running for re-election against Representative Joe McDermott. And not Joe McDermott. I'm getting my former state legislators mixed up. Jim McIntyre is running against him. And the problem getting my races mixed up. Yes.
Because McIntyre's running for treasurer.
Yes, he is. I skipped a paragraph here. I'm looking at my notes. We went with Reed, and the reason for it is fairly simple, that in the 2004 race, he came under enormous pressure from his own party, basically to throw the race to Dino Rossi when Gregoire won by 100 and some votes. And he didn't. He stuck with two recounts, and three recounts, and a court process, and was pretty scrupulously fair throughout, even when he was under a lot of pressure from his own party to make some decisions that he didn't, and to champion vote fraud that didn't exist, and these sorts of things. And I think that sort of integrity is as much as you can ask for from a state treasurer, or from a secretary of state, rather. So we're endorsing Reed again. The reason I conflated it with state treasurer is that we are actually endorsing two Republicans in a row here. This is kind of an unusual situation. The incumbent Democrat, Mike Murphy, is retiring. He's endorsing his number two, Alan Martin, who is running as a Republican. Jim McIntyre is running as his Democratic opponent. And the problem here is that McIntyre is one of the seemingly endless supply of Democrats in the state legislature from Seattle who never really does much of anything but occupy a warm seat. He really hasn't done anything, in my view anyway, to merit a promotion. And Martin, at least according to his current boss, namely the incumbent Mike Murphy, has. And so we're going with Alan Martin on that one. And that, again, the state treasurer, like the secretary of state, like the state auditor, which is the next one, are offices where you really don't want a partisan so much as you want someone who's technically proficient and will simply
do
the job.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the state auditor, Brian Sontag is the incumbent. Yeah, this is his, I believe he's going for his fifth term now. He recently had a performance audit of Sound Transit that turned out to be invaluable, or rather of Port of Seattle that turned out to be valuable. He's working on Sound Transit next, and that just shows, I think, his value all over again. So we're going with Sontag on that. The next couple of races are a little bit more contested. Attorney General, the incumbent is Rob McKenna, the Republican, who very much wants to become governor in 2012, assuming Dino Rossi doesn't win, which I think McKenna is doing. He's young, he's slick, he's photogenic, he's very well spoken. He is basically a tool of the most conservative and, if not reactionary, lobby in the state, the Building Industry Association of Washington. And it's much easier to stop him now than it would be to stop him in 2012, to be quite frank about it. Not only that, but he's running against somebody who is a very competent and credible opponent, John Ladenburg, who is the Pierce County executive and also has been the chair of the Committee of Elected Officials that oversees Sound Transit during the period of time when they actually righted their ship and went from being pretty badly mismanaged to getting themselves back on track. So we're going with Ladenburg on this one. McKenna has had a mixed to dubious record as Attorney General, and Ladenburg would be definitely an improvement.
And Gregoire is an example of what this office can produce for the state. She became governor, and she's been a good governor, and she was Attorney General prior to that. So this is an important race, and folks should pay close attention to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Commissioner of Public Lands. This is a real easy one. The incumbent is two-term Republican Doug Sutherland. He's got several problems. We mentioned a couple of weeks ago the sexual harassment issue that's come up with him. More directly related to his job performance is the fact that he's never met a clear cut that he doesn't like. And if you ask the people of, say, Centralia, Chehalis, Lewis County, what that can do for your public lands that he is supposedly a steward of, I'm sure they would be happy to tell you. He is running against a very good candidate on the Democratic side, Peter Goldmark, who, if the name sounds familiar, he ran against he ran in Eastern Washington for Congress 2 years ago and did unexpectedly well against Kathy McMorris Rogers. He's a rancher from Okanagan County, very progressive. Trained professionally in ways that Sutherland is not, that are appropriate to being a steward of public lands, and he's a much better choice. So Peter Goldmark for Commissioner of Public Lands. Superintendent of Public Instruction. The incumbent is Terry I Love Wassel Bergeson. She probably should be turfed out of office just for that alone, but in my view anyway, she's been something of a disaster over the last couple of terms. Randy Dorn is the most credible and prominent of several people who are running against her, and we have endorsed Randy Dorn for that office. And then Insurance Commissioner, it's a three-person race. The incumbent is Mike Creedler. He is running against two people who are both working in the insurance industry, oddly enough, foxes and hen houses alert. So we are going with the incumbent in that one, Mike Creedler.
I understand Creedler is just loathed by the insurance companies, which is a good sign.
Yeah,
that's what his job is. To be a public advocate for patients and for the people of Washington State, not for insurance companies.
And frankly, if the insurance companies loved him, he would probably be cause for great worry.
Yes.
And then we mentioned we were going to do the one ballot initiative this week also, and that is Initiative 26, which is a little bit complicated because it's a two-part question. The one part is whether, and it has bearing on, it's not just a straw poll for November. It is two parts. The first part is whether I-26 should actually go on the ballot in November. And then the second part is whether it should go on as the and the wording that was originally circulated in the petitions that were signed by the public, or whether a county council alternative should go on the ballot. And I-26 is an effort by local Republicans to make the offices of county executive, county council, and there was one other, I think it was the county auditor.
County assessor,
be nonpartisan. And the problem with the basic premise behind this is because it's becoming demographically more difficult, and Ron Sims can attest to this, to elect countywide Republicans in King County. And so there, the idea isn't that this would make the candidates nonpartisan. It was make the offices nonpartisan, so they wouldn't tell you if they didn't want you to know what parties they were affiliated with.
Who's a Republican and who's not.
And as we've already seen, this is much on Republican minds. We have Dino prefers GOP party Rossi running for governor. And he, if that sounds preposterous that he's labeling himself as GOP party, which is, by the way, grammatically a crime against humanity. but beyond that, why he's labeling himself that rather than Republican, apparently polls show that about 25% of the public doesn't know that GOP and Republican are the same thing. So it tells you that the Republicans are perfectly aware that the Republican brand is pretty damaged at this point, and that they are trying very, and that's even more true in King County than it is statewide. And so they're essentially trying to make sure that voters have less information when they go into the polls. So we're recommending a no vote on that, but we are also recommending the second part of the ballot question is whether to choose between the original wording and the county council approved alternative, which was approved on a party line vote by the Democratic majority, which would be to make the offices nonpartisan but allow candidates to state a party preference on the ballot. And the idea is that if the yes vote passes this time so that it appears on the November ballot, which version will appear on the November ballot, and we're suggesting that people vote for the council-approved alternative.
All right. Moving on to sticking with local, the cancer rates in South Seattle.
Oh, yeah. If you live in South Seattle, you have a much elevated cancer risk because of air pollution. South Seattle environmental activists had asked the health department and the U.S. Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry to study the risks related to air pollution in South Seattle. That's where more than half of the city's population live, by the way, in the affected area. And just as a comparison, the federal target for people who live in areas with exposure to toxic waste is about one case of cancer in a million. That's their target. Above that is considered a risk that needs to be addressed. Well, the results of the study showed that people who live in South Seattle have an elevated risk everywhere throughout the region, but the worst areas are near major freeways, where you would expect to find 3,600 cases of cancer in 1 million people. You get the same risk if you live near the north end of Boeing Field and also in pockets of higher risk areas near industrial places. And cancer is not the only risk, too. We should point out that air pollution can cause problems with asthma, bronchitis, pneumonia, other lung diseases, and it also increases your risk of stroke and heart attack. The most interesting thing about this study is that it may be actually lowballing the risks, because they didn't look at any of the emissions produced by the Port of Seattle. Significant diesel emissions are produced from ships, railroads, and the port machinery that operates every day during the week in South Seattle, and as well along the waterfront all the way north. And another interesting thing about the study is that it was only done in South Seattle. It was not done in the rest of the city, and it was only done in South Seattle because environmental activists requested it. So,
all right. Moving on to national, and sticking with the subject of toxic substances, there was further developments this
that
week.
That could lead to almost anything.
Yeah.
It's still wide open. Developments in the anthrax case this week.
Yeah, the FBI is trying to say that they can that it's time to close the case on the anthrax mailings. And this is after declaring Dr. Ivins the anthrax killer, and Dr. Ivins committed suicide a little over a week ago. And they're saying that they had that they have definitive proof. Well, the problem is that the FBI released papers this week of this so-called definitive proof, and it turns out that the proof is actually very circumstantial and that it is missing definitive proof. There's no smoking gun amongst all of this evidence. And as one scientist said, there's enough here to justify a search. However, when the searches were done of Dr. Ivan's home, his office, and his vehicles, there was no definitive proof found. So It all leads to the question of, well, you know, what actually happened here with this FBI investigation? It looks like that the FBI turned to surveillance and harassment of Dr. Ivins and his family in order to try to get a confession or to get the definitive proof that they needed to prove that he was the guy who did the anthrax mailings. And instead what they did was they drove him to suicide. Now, that's not an investigation. That's abuse. So the spotlight really needs to be turned back on the FBI here in how they conducted the investigation, and asking some real questions about why it took so long to get such little information on this.
And not only that, but I mean the smoking gun is missing and the evidence is circumstantial, pointing toward Ivan's involvement at all. But even if you accept the idea that he was involved, the question then becomes, was he acting alone? And that is something else that's not being addressed at all, particularly because you had warnings in D.C. of a possible biological attack, and people, journalists in particular, being told to stock up on Cipro several days before the first attack. So clearly word of something was circulating somewhere. And the question is, why did this investigation take so long? Why did it lurch from one to another subject based largely on circumstantial evidence and is now being walked away from entirely without any kind of definitive answer? There's just a lot more questions than there are answers at this point.
So the FBI's efforts to show that this case should be closed are, people should look at that and say, no, this case should not be closed. And in fact, we need to look at the whole FBI investigation and how it was conducted.
Well, and luckily, the John Dingell and Bart Stupak, who are on the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, are asking and pushing for an investigation. And they've been doing recently they've been doing several House hearings on high security biolab proliferation and problems with that. So this actually
kind of dovetails with that.
Yeah. Exactly. And
The other thing, which was mentioned briefly on Counterspin, Glenn Greenwald has been doing a series of excellent columns over at Salon talking about not just these issues, but also the context in which the anthrax attacks were used very much to heighten the fear in this country post 9/11 and to link the anthrax attacks and terrorism with Saddam Hussein. So this is not just a question of terrorism and the murders that took place, but it's also very politically charged.
Or even just looking at the FBI and the way their investigation was conducted. He's also looking at the media and how they pursued the whole story as well. That's also a very interesting issue.
Yeah, ABC pretty much pushing the bentonite connection to Iraq that really didn't exist. All right, just a few minutes left. The Hamdan case, another case.
Yeah, the first Guantanamo Military Tribunal has concluded the case against Salim Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's driver. And the verdict was a little bit of a shock to the prosecutors, but not to anybody who's been actually following the case. He was found guilty on only one charge, that he supported terrorism by being bin Laden's driver and bodyguard, which should come as no surprise to anybody. He was found not guilty on all of the other charges, including the most serious conspiracy charges that charged he was part of the September 11th attack. The only charges that he had faced before the Bush administration rewrote the rules was the charge on these conspiracy issues. So if he had been tried earlier before the Supreme Court had ruled and the Bush administration had rewritten the rules for who could be tried in these tribunals, then he would have been found not guilty on all charges. He was found not guilty on the charge even that he knew his work would be used for terrorism. So that tells you something about how low level he was in the organization. He was he was found to be a war criminal just because he chauffeured the wrong guy at the wrong time. In the sentencing, this was also reflected. The Bush administration prosecutors had asked for life in prison for a guy who was driving around the wrong guy at the wrong time. The jury instead gave him 5.5 years with credit for some of the time that he's already some of the 7 years that he's already spent in custody at Guantanamo, which means he could be released by the end of this year. Of course, the military says that they reserve the right to hold these convicted war criminals even after their sentence has been completed. So I doubt he will be released. But I also want to point out that this trial was pretty clearly a dress rehearsal. The prosecutors just kind of shrugged their shoulders at the verdict, and when they had a chance to push for a mistrial, they passed it up, asking instead for a definition from the judge on what he considered to be a clarification on what he considered to be a war crime, so that they could get ready for the next guys they're going to bring to trial. So I just want to point that out for folks.
Yeah. In case you're bringing score, all of the handful of people who've actually been brought to trial on terrorism charges since 9/11, almost all of them have either been convicted of lesser charges or not convicted at all. None of them have actually been convicted of the crimes that they were originally accused of. And as we've seen in this case, it happened despite the fact that this was as close to a kangaroo court as you could possibly have won. He was still essentially exonerated on all of the more serious charges. So it tells you what a farce it was that he still may not be released.
All right. Very briefly, the CDC report on emergency rooms.
Yeah, the CDC released a report saying that average emergency room waiting time has gone from 38 minutes in 1996 up to an hour in 2006. They say there's been a 32% increase in emergency room visits, and 50% of hospital admissions now come through the ER versus only around 36% the way, you know, in 1996, a decade ago. And you could ask the question why, but the whys appear to be very obvious. There are fewer general practitioners now. Most people who go through medical school become a specialist because it pays more. Fewer hospitals and hospital beds now because, of course, hospitals are part of the for-profit sector now, not supported by government money anymore, and a lot have gone under. And there are more uninsured people using the emergency rooms as their chance to visit the doctor. So a lot of problems with healthcare. And when the Harris Interactive did their poll surveying 1,000 Americans on how they felt about the healthcare system, 82% said that the U.S. healthcare system needs a major overhaul.
All right. And finally, briefly, Pakistan.
Go ahead. Pakistan, yes. The Pakistan Governing Coalition, which is a shaky coalition at best, has finally decided that they are going to pursue impeachment proceedings against General Musharraf. This is should come as no surprise, although the Bush administration, interestingly, has kind of stepped back and said, well, you know, it's an internal matter for Pakistan, essentially washing their hands of Musharraf.
Yeah, as though the United States has ever passed on the opportunity to intervene in internal Pakistani affairs before.
Yes.
All right. And finally, events.
Yeah, several of them. Today, there's a couple things going on. We mentioned last week that there had been ongoing actions at the Port of Tacoma around shipments to Fort Lewis in support of the war in Iraq. There is a rally to wrap up that campaign today. It will be at 4 o'clock at Marine Park on Ruston Way, north of Schuster Parkway. Also, today is the first day of the annual weekend of actions commemorating the annual bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action and the Bangor Nuclear Subbase over in Kitsap County. That encampment begins today. There will be a nonviolence training, and Monday morning there will be a civil disobedience. And then want to do an early plug this week for next Saturday. Eat the State will be having its summer barbecue and annual picnic from 1 to 4 o'clock on Saturday the 16th, a week from today, out at Woodland Park. Picnic tables 17 and 18 at the north end of the park, and we're also using it as a tie-in for our summer fun drive, and we're starting to get dangerously short of money, so anything that you can do to support us, or if you want to just come to our barbecue next week and hang out and meet us and
have a chance to
complain about the presidential race or whatever else you want to, that'd be great.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with the State, and very briefly, where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, places around town where you find free publications laying around, or you can also find us in public libraries, or you can catch us on the web at www.eatthestate.org.
Which, and we recommend you use the PayPal button on that website
to
as well.
To make a donation.
Yes.